Hey, this is Daryl Etherington, and I'm here with
Anthony Ha.
And we are bringing you original content, TechCrunch's podcast about all things streaming and media, and we don't even care anymore. Just cool stuff that is video.
We literally cover the world, anything,
yeah,
anything at all.
Yeah, exactly.
And this week we're going to be reviewing the new Netflix series, Godless.
Yes, and also talking about some news, but qualifier, limited series. Did you notice that? They made it very clear.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a sort of a kind of a fuzzy line because, I mean, like, you know, something like Stranger Things looks like it's a limited series until, like, it gets a second season and then, oh, I guess it's an ongoing thing.
Right. But with this one, it was like it was a requirement of them getting it to air. Is they badged it everywhere with limited series.
Right, like right.
Text. Yeah.
Yeah, it was the first time I'd seen that.
Yeah, yeah, me
label
too. Anyways, sidetrack.
Yeah.
Let's start where we usually start, talking about the news of the week in streaming.
Yeah, so I think the first story we wanted to talk about was House of Cards, which I think most people know production was halted on the sixth season after these allegations came to light around Kevin Spacey, you know, initially with Anthony Rapp saying that when Rapp was a teenager, Kevin Spacey had, like, basically made, you know, a sexual advance on him. And then I think other allegations came out about his behavior on the set of House of Cards. So at that point, you know, I think you and I have talked about how, geez, like, is there even a sixth season of House of Cards? Is this, you know, just the end? And it sounds like they're still trying to move forward with the sixth season. They've said that they're going to try to start production in December, like after December 8th. But it seems like a lot of stuff is still up in the air.
Yeah, it does. Like what it will look like or who will be in it. And
right. Kevin Spacey, I mean, if it does happen, and it sounds like they're trying to make it happen, Kevin Spacey will not be in it. And so it'll be, you know, if it comes back, and I think...
Well, the lead image on this article that we're citing for this is Robin Wright, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that seems like a pretty good indicator of where things will probably go.
Right.
In terms of
But focus. Like they shot, I guess, so this is an article in TV Line, and it says they've shot two episodes so far before that production halt. And so I guess one of the questions is, do they just scrap what they have so far and, like, you know, come up with something completely new for the sixth season, or they keep those first two episodes, and then between episodes two and three, you know, Frank Underwood is just, you know, unceremoniously killed off or shuffled off stage.
Yeah. They said all signs point to the character suffering an off-screen death, which I guess that's basically, it sounds like it's probably just an assumption, because, like, what else would you do?
Right.
Or maybe they can make a CG version of him and then kill him in that way.
Yeah.
That would be kind of like a Schadenfreude thing, I think, that people would want to see, maybe. But I don't know. It's going to be tricky regardless. I mean, at this point, it's just kind of like fan service, is it? Like, let's give fans of the show some kind of ending, some kind of cap to this thing that they've been watching for 5 years, 6 years?
Right. Well, I think also they've spent a certain amount of money on the sixth season, and Netflix has probably paid for the sixth season already. So they're kind of like, let's do it. Let's
right.
You know, some amount of people will still watch it. So let's go for it.
Yeah, they want to recoup their investment for sure, I'm sure.
But it's hard to imagine. And then I think this is, you know, I mean, obviously this is like a pretty messed up and grim situation, but there's something about it that's just also like trying to figure out how to make this work from a dramatic perspective that just seems so preposterous that it's also, yeah, it just seems like such a nightmarish situation for the showrunners.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe a good challenge, like a fun writing prompt. Like, here's the situation. Fix it in a way that is believable.
Yeah, I mean, I have only seen the first season of House of Cards, so I don't know exactly where things stand. I assume that Kevin Spacey is still president.
Yeah, I also
on the
don't
show.
Know. I have no idea, like, how often he was or wasn't president.
But I can't say for sure, but it seems to me that, like, it would be smarter to, like, actually, if you're gonna do it, you know, start the beginning, like reconceive the entire season, mm-hmm. rather than having two episodes that were clearly going in one direction and then just like radically changing course two episodes in. That seems to me like it would be, you know, way harder. But again, I don't really know exactly where the show stands.
Yeah, it's possible they were at a point where weirdly it's like natural for them to go to that, but that would be, you know, a huge coincidence if it were true. So yeah, it's weird. I don't envy anybody their job and having to wrap that up. I think that's the best way to go too. Like it's just be so much easier on everyone. But maybe that's where Netflix's bottom line comes in, and they're like, you know what, we don't want to do that. Even if you did a curtailed season, right, and you just scrapped it,
right.
And you did like, you didn't do two more episodes to make up for that, new ones. You just said, we're never going to air these episodes. And then right. they'll become a fun piece of trivia for future Hollywood cinephiles or whatever. They can be like, oh, did you ever see the unreleased episodes? And, I mean, it works. It's good for everybody that way if you do it like that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing is like that House of Cards is, you know, was this the flagship for Netflix. And so I think on some level they want to try to, and now it's, you know, just completely tainted by association with, you know, I mean, A, just the fact that it has Kevin Spacey in it, but that it was sort of at the center of, you know, the fallout from it. And so I think this is maybe in some way a way to try to move the show beyond that. And so that like you can still have the show on Netflix and people will still want to watch it rather than just being like, oh, that's the incomplete show that Kevin Spacey was fired from.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're also doing the spinoffs, right?
So, oh, I think they've talked about, yeah, potentially doing spinoffs and things like that. I don't know where I think all of that is. It seems like, I mean, this article that we're talking, this report that we're talking about doesn't mention the spinoffs at all. I know that we there were discussions of spinoffs, and so
I think there was some. There was at least one article that said they were still considering those.
Yeah,
like, following the fallout. So maybe that's the one of the purposes behind this too, is to set those up.
Right. Exactly. And you know, just, yeah, get this wrapped up and then move on to some spinoffs or something.
Yeah. Well, I didn't watch it. I don't plan on continuing or on starting watching it. So it doesn't affect me personally.
Yeah. It's one of those shows that I feel like everyone's watched, but like no one's actually fully caught up on, like, and yeah. People are like, it's like, where did you fall off of House of Cards?
Yeah. Another one like that to me is The Walking Dead. And it feels very similar to me in terms right. of like, at some point it dropped a lot of people. Mad Men too.
Yeah, I mean, I think any show that just runs that length, it just becomes a big ask, you know, like if it's two or three seasons, then you're kind of like, well, why aren't you all caught up? I mean, I think like the one show that's managed to avoid that is Game of Thrones, just because mm-hmm. it's such a juggernaut, like a cultural force that like everyone still watches. And I mean, it has the advantage also of having these, you know, that even though it's run for, you know, seven seasons now, it only has like 67 hours, so like that's, which is still a lot, but it's nothing compared to like Walking Dead or something like that, which runs like, you know, these long 20 episode seasons.
Yeah Game of Thrones is just 30 or so movies,
right?
Put that way, it's easy.
right. I mean, I still think, I mean, the people I know who haven't started it yet, still, you know, I think then they see how much there is that they find it intimidating, but it isn't like the thing where I think people who've been watching, you know, once you've watched like three or four seasons, you're basically fully committed.
Yeah. Yeah, you are. You're in.
Right. Cause you're just like, I need to know what happens.
It is that. It's totally that. It's like it's not even about specific enjoyment of like the individual episodes. It's like, I just need to know what happens in the end. And you right. kind of could just tune in at the end and probably be satisfied, but I don't know. We'll
right.
see. But then you'll be like, where did this guy go?
Yeah. My girlfriend, had not seen any episodes of Game of Thrones, but I talked her into coming to a viewing party for the season 7 premiere.
Yeah.
And so she was just like frantically trying to read Wikipedia beforehand.
Oh no.
And I kept being like, don't worry about it. It's, you're not going to get caught up. you know, just try to enjoy it on its own terms, which has happened when people have come and like watched one of the big spectacular battle episodes.
Yeah.
Where you're just kind of like, you're rooting for this guy you're kind of rooting for. These guys are definitely bad.
But not one of the in-between exposition episodes, which are right. Like a boring series.
Yeah, it
series
didn't work
of
as well for this one. Yeah, she just fell asleep about 20 minutes.
Oh, cool, cool.
And now I'm single again. No.
I think that Mora should do, like we were joking about the limited series thing before. I think it's actually quite effective, and I hope to see more people do that. Like, to me, well, we can talk about when we get into the review about why I feel that way, but
yeah.
Okay, you want to move on to more news, other news?
Yeah. Now that we've spent 5 minutes talking about Game of Thrones, there's a projection from Gene Munster, an analyst who I think is a very well respected analyst, but it also is sort of, I think, notorious in the tech press for being the guy who on every earnings discussion about Apple is like, hey, what about the TV? What about the TV? What about the TV? So he's projecting that Apple could spend $4.2 billion on original content by 2022.
Yeah. So this is interesting because you got to consider the source. And Munster's sort of known for being a person who predicted a bunch of stuff that never happened at Apple. That's kind of his shtick. And it's almost like you could use his last name as a verb for doing that. But as the Variety article about this says, he is a longtime Apple watcher, so I guess that's something. but yeah.
That's a description that applies to a lot of people.
Though. Sure. I mean, me too, technically, yeah. But and you kind of can see where his figuring is coming from, right? Like, we have the report already that they're going to spend $1 billion next year. So by 2022, 4.2, like, it's almost just a lot like raising it out with like a somewhat speeding curve, I think, over the years after that, which is basically all analysts do, by the way. I hope there's analysts listening to this call, but
I'm sure that this is, well, they probably don't work that hard, so why not listen to
up and to the right or up and to to the right and down is all they do based on the information of the past couple of years. And they're almost always wrong, by the way, almost always. Sorry, this turned into a bit of a mini rant against analysts.
Well, the other thing they do is they like to divide things into quadrants, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
like,
sure.
this is what the landscape looks like. We'll just put things in quadrants.
Yeah. This is going to be great audio when, like, I inevitably become an analyst.
Somebody plays. No, every firm now is going to be like, no, we're not hiring Daryl. Fuck Daryl.
Cool. Anyway, yeah, it seems reasonable. Especially given, the trend of some of their rivals, if they want to make a serious go of it among Amazon and among Netflix. But I think the other stuff that's more interesting about this is that, like, he's thinking, like, that's going to feed a transformation sort of the Apple Music service. It sounds like he's envisioning Apple Music becomes more like the digital side of Amazon Prime than what it is now. And that could be interesting. And I like, that's an idea that has a lot of legs, I think, in terms of something Apple could do to link its work with like its digital services and its services side business, and then also its like hardware stuff. Like, you could see a Prime that exists just for the Apple ecosystem of devices and content, and that feels interest in either, right? Like, that would be really compelling if you got something that like incorporated iCloud and like iCloud storage. And music and movies and TV, and maybe worked in with Apple's like device upgrade program or something too. Like, that would be super compelling, I think.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess I think some of the other discussion had been whether or not it's going to be more like, you know, this stuff just breaks out of Apple Music and just becomes a completely separate service.
Yeah. Yeah, like so Apple Movies or Apple whatever, Apple Media or streaming or something, right?
Right. But,
yeah.
And to me, that makes more sense than just sort of this catch-all. But I mean, I could see it going either way. Yeah, but I agree that that's maybe a little bit more interesting than just the number, because on some level, it seems like just such a speculative thing of like, yes, if Apple's bet on original content does well, it will spend more money on it.
Right.
Apple has a lot of money, and so it will spend billions of dollars. And you're like, well, yeah, sure, that makes sense. But
and it'll increase it at a cautiously optimistic rate. Like, it's like, okay, yeah, right. That's true.
But like, that's so contingent on like, I mean, you know, I think any sort of like of these kind of like projections is to an extent, you know, fantasy math. But I think that's particularly true when like, you know, essentially none of the bigger, you know, bets on original content have launched yet. So who knows if it's going to go well and how Apple will respond when it does well or doesn't do well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because you called that part speculative and the other part where we invented an entire Amazon Prime for Apple stuff.
Right. Is
purely speculative, but yeah, I mean, the one part is speculative and also uninteresting, whereas the other part is like, could be an actual, like, if you look at their strategy overall with original content and with how it's housed in music and all that stuff, a lot of it is baffling. So to provide some kind of path that starts to make sense of that, like strategically, I think is useful.
Right.
That's what that does.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I think part of what makes some of the speculation, I think, particularly challenging is because obviously, I mean, some of this is just like people sitting outside being like, this is what Apple should do. Some of this is also like, well, this is sort of what the rumblings are within Apple or Apple's conversations with partners. And I think, you know, most of the time it turns out, yes, Apple is exploring a lot of these avenues because it knows that it should be making, you know, bets in these certain areas. But that doesn't mean it's actually going to make these bets. It just means that it's exploring it and some of them will actually pan out and some of them will not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing too. So I think the next big indicators of whether it is panning out or not are going to be the Amazing Stories reboot. And then also their big drama comedy series or whatever, the morning show series.
Oh, yeah. With
Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston. Yeah.
Right. So. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So though, based on those, because so far they've done nothing to indicate that they should continue, I think.
Right. All we get a sense of is like, oh, they're going to be doing, you know, is that they want to spend a lot of money. But those are the two big announcements so far. And then, of course, obviously, you know, the shows that have come out so far have been not great and not done particularly well. Although I think those may not be representative of the direction that they're going to be going in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I say the show so far, I mean Planet of the Apps and Carpool Karaoke.
Yeah. Worthwhile pointing it out because some people might not be aware they exist.
Right. And they're not missing anything. You're definitely not missing anything.
Exactly. You don't need to worry about that. Yeah. All right. So, I mean, I hope they do. I want this to be true because I feel like it's worthwhile for Apple to enter this market just in that when Apple enters markets, it makes interesting things happen to the rest of it. Like, they're usually not beholden in the same way as some of their competitors to maybe the power players, right? Like, they don't have to make deals with anybody else who holds a legacy power in that industry.
Right.
Because they're powerful enough to stand on their own and, you know, if they wanted to purchase all the other players in that industry. So it's a good competitive driver no matter where they happen to operate, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think how that's played out in different industries is, it's different. I mean, that like, you know, that I think as the most famous example is that in music that they were able to basically come in and say, this is how pricing is going to work. And this is, you know, and really like kind of set the standard for how, you know, digital music like was going to be sold on the internet, with iTunes. I think it's been less successful sort of on the book side. And then as it's moved into, you know, streaming, you know, subscription streaming music, not to say that it hasn't been successful, but just that it hasn't remade an industry the way I think iTunes really completely remade an industry.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Is that anything else you thought about this or no?
No. I think, yeah, just we'll see what happens. And Gene Munster, always funny.
Always funny. That guy. He's got a good gig, though. I mean, people pick up.
I mean, I'm sure that he makes as much money as like the two of us combined several times over.
Yeah, for sure. So it's fair. We're allowed to make fun of him and all other analysts.
Right. That's right.
Cool. So any more news?
Well, I think the last thing we wanted to touch on was just that the trailer for Avengers Infinity War has come out, or the first trailer, rather.
Yeah, that's right. There will be more, I'm sure.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, I think in the same way that, like, before, you know, the first trailer for the Avengers hit, there was this thing of, like, how, what is this even going to be? Like, how, like, you know, just, it's going to be so much. Is it just going to look ridiculous?
Yeah, and like, so, you feel like this could have just been a Too Many Cooks style video or whatever.
Right.
Where they just put people's, like, 1 second of their face, and that could fill out a 2 minute trailer because there's such an expansive cast for this, right?
Right. So it's basically the entire, every single superhero that's been, you know, featured in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think minus Ant-Man. I don't remember seeing Ant-Man, but pretty much everyone else is in it.
I think he is in it, but they didn't show him in the trailer, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean, is that he'll be in the movie, but he just wasn't. Like, if you watch the trailer even, they pretty much highlight everyone gets their moment except for Ant-Man.
And yet, even though they did it, it didn't feel like just a, like, it was strictly a business, like, trotting out of all the people. It felt like, okay, this, I can see how this would be a cohesive story, maybe, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had some friends who I think just said it felt like a Too Many Cooks style video.
Yeah, I guess.
But so. I think
I thought it was a little more artful. I thought it was like, okay, because I start, and maybe too artful in terms of like being able to piece together plot. I think our colleague Matt Burns was talking about how he felt like there were too many spoilers in it. But I didn't think there was anything particularly spoilery. It was just like, okay, maybe if you wanted to keep yourself completely immune to all information about this.
Right. I mean, because I feel like, well, part of the spoilers, I mean, I haven't asked Matt what specifically he was talking about, but it felt to me like the main spoilers, like, yep, that person's in it. Yep, they're in it too.
Oh,
yep,
right.
They're also in it. Yeah. And everybody's in it.
But we knew that. We knew that. Or if you'd been paying attention, you knew that, right?
Yeah, I think if you'd been following, you know, the news around the movie. But to your point about being sort of artfully, you know, made, you know, at least artful in the context of superhero movie trailers. it does, like, introduce Thanos or reintroduce him as this, you know, slightly more active character. Because, I mean, in all of his appearances so far, he's basically just been this guy in the chair who is a jerk.
Yeah. Yeah, he has. And that was the big difference. Like, he... I don't know how many movies he's appeared in. 3, 4?
Let's see. He was definitely in both of the previous Avengers movies. He was in the first Guardians of the Galaxy. I don't know if he's been in any others that I can think of off the top of my head. Maybe he made an appearance.
Like post-credit scenes?
Yeah.
Yeah. But he, yeah, he's always been this, and, you know, he looks kind of like a, he looks like an extra, like a theme park or something, like in all the previous ones to me. It's just like, okay, here's this guy sitting in a thing. He like makes one sort of, he just glares. He kind of glares, I guess. Makes some comments in his growly voice. But looks very, very cartoonish.
Yeah.
Which is not, like, it's hard to make a thing that is a giant purple alien not look cartoonish, I guess. But yeah, in this, it struck me as very different. Like the way they depict him in this, and I guess if you're a super stickler about trailer spoilers, which some people are, you can turn away now or skip to the next chapter. But the first shot we get of him is like without helmet, and he looks a lot. I think they've toned down the purple too, I feel like.
Yeah.
They've made him look a lot more human in the face and in his expression. Like the Brolin underneath really comes through, and Josh Brolin, who's playing him, by the way. But it was good. It was probably my favorite part about the trailer. I was just like, oh, Thanos looks good as opposed to bad or hokey or
right
purely CG, right? Like purely obviously CG.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like the combination of, I think that the design has been tweaked, so he looks a little bit less crazy. Although, I mean, I like sort of cartoonish and you know, like over more the out there designs too.
Yeah.
But I can see that, I mean, as the centerpiece villain of this movie, I think it's a little tougher.
Oh, Marvel fans are concerned over Thanos changing colors, though.
Apparently. Oh, God. And then, like, there's, you know, the fact that, you know, yeah, just everything we've seen of him essentially, with like maybe one exception, has been him in that, you know, giant space throne room on his dumb floating chair. Mm-hmm. And he just, like, you know, doesn't look that threatening because he's just like sitting there, like raging, but not really doing anything.
Yeah. Yeah, wearing his big helmet.
Right. Like, and so now you actually see him like being active in this universe. And then because I think it leans more on the Brolin, like there's a long monologue, you know, long in the context of a trailer monologue that he delivers. And so you really get the sense of Josh Brolin playing Thanos as opposed to this CGI character.
Yeah. Yeah. And he like, it's weird because he's not in his like full armor regalia that he's been in the past movies. Which was a very imposing, like intimidating outfit, obviously. But I felt he's more threatening in this trailer than he's ever been because of the way he's like vocalized by Brolin and the what looks like to be very, very good CG work in terms of like the subtlety of facial expression capture and stuff like that. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, like,
Marvel fans are very angry about the fact that he's been at least four shades of purple thus far. So,
I mean, I thought it was a good trailer, but I do still wonder about, like, to what extent the movie is going to be. I mean, it seems like just, you know, by the fact that it's a 2-hour movie and it has this many Marvel characters, like, it's got to focus on just, like, a handful of them. And then there's going to be a lot of people who are just making, you know, very brief appearances, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It seemed like some of the people, like, what was interesting was at the end they did, like, the run of, like, the team running into battle. And that looked like the hero shot of, like, here's the core team. And it involved, like, an unusual group. Like, it was, like, Bucky, Cap, Black Panther's Royal Guard or sister? I'm not sure because I haven't seen those movies yet. But and like maybe not Wanda, Black Widow was it? I think.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, but it was like an interesting group for them to like leave you with, right? The rest right. of there's like the, it seems like there's going to be maybe teams that might be the way they handle it, where there's like a few different groups that they jump between to kind of keep it a bit more manageable. The other being like Doctor Strange, Hulk. I forget who else was in that. Was Thor in that? Or was Thor only at the very end?
A few glimpses of Thor, I think, throughout, and then he's got that big moment at the end.
Yeah, so Thor's up with the Guardians of the Galaxy in the spaceship, right. Which is like, that kind of makes sense too, like especially given the tone of the most recent Thor movie.
Right. It's
like that's a good group to kind of focus. And then the group, the one that I talked about before with the Captain America, Bucky, et cetera, that's like the Captain America group, if you want to call it that. Like that basically could have been the core characters lifted out of the most recent Captain America movie.
Right. Well, and then also, the most recent Captain America movie had these factions because of Civil War.
Yeah.
And so there's like, Team Captain America, Team Iron Man, and then Thor was, you know, the one guy who was the one Avenger who wasn't really a part of that.
Yeah, the loose radical or whatever. Yeah. I think Spider-Man will be on that Iron Man crew, I guess, since he's basically his vassal knight or whatever, like wearing his suit. That suit, I don't like that. That was the one thing I was like, I wish they had not gone with this suit for this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I wasn't crazy about it.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the other thing was that I was watching it before the call because I haven't seen it yet, and Anthony was listening, and I laughed at the final shot of the Guardians of the Galaxy assembled, and I was laughing at Chris Pratt with his mustache. He looks like a bit dumpier, and then like with a mustache, it was a combination.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I mean, he famously, you know, like went through like a crazy workout to get fit for the first Guardians, and you know, has basically been in that sort of mode since then. But you know, maybe for Avengers, it was
maybe he let it go.
Yeah, you know, like that. He's not working as many days on that probably. So why go all out?
Did Ego have a mustache in the last movie?
Did
or no? He had a full beard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I thought maybe he was like taking on his father's cool stash or something, even though he hates him and killed him. But
right.
Oh, spoiler, sorry. Don't. Oh man, maybe I should bleep that.
I leave it to you.
No, it's fine.
I think it's fine. Yeah. That movie's been out for a while. It's playing on planes now.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, cool. Well, I it got me excited. I did the job of the trailer. I didn't leave it thinking like, oh, I don't want to see this. But mostly, like, there was the too many cooks cavalcade of heroes, which is fine, whatever.
Right.
Also, the one thing I thought I kind of maybe like detective worked was Hulk. I feel like that was Hulk's return from space.
Yeah.
Was just like, because there was a clear comet-like hole in Doctor Strange's mansion. I feel like he like fell to Earth and then was just there, and they're like, oh, good thing you came back from the planet Scar or whatever it was. Or where did he end up being actually at the end of Thor?
He's still with Thor.
Oh, right. Okay. So yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Right.
Anyways, yeah, I'm excited about it, but it mostly because of Roland and Thanos and less because of the other ones. And that's really nice and refreshing for me with these big superhero epics, because I feel like it's just been like one badly animated CG villain after another.
Right. And you haven't seen Justice League, but Justice League is I'm one of the people who actually kind of likes Justice League, but like Justice League is definitely the worst offender as far as like shitty CG animated villains.
Yeah. I think it's been worse on the DC side. Like they had that, they had Doomsday, and they had Mars, and you know, none of that was good.
Right.
But even like, oh, what's his name? There aren't no strings on me. Ultron.
Gosh. Ultron, yeah.
Even Ultron, like Spader did a good job with the voice acting, but
right.
The thing itself was like, okay, another CG thing. So.
Right. Yeah, I think there were interesting things about it, but he wasn't a great villain. I mean, Marvel in general, I mean, I think it has less to do with like the CG animation, but just in general hasn't, I think, had particularly memorable or interesting villains. Except for this, except for Loki, that's the exception everyone brings up. And I think this year with like Kurt Russell and Kate Blanchett, I think that those characters in Thor and Guardians were at least a bit more interesting than usual.
Yeah, they were. And they were CG heavy too. But they still...
But you could see their faces.
Yeah, exactly. That was the key difference. And it looks like they redesigned Thanos purposely to take advantage of that or to make the same thing happen.
Right. Yeah, and that they had CG elements, but like it was still a human performance as opposed to like a CG character with like performance capture or whatever. It was still it was a human face, and like Kurt Russell was like mostly just in costume until the end.
Yeah. Yeah, Russell's good too. That was good. Okay, cool. So check it out if you haven't seen the trailer, for sure. Check it out on TechCrunch.com.
That's right.
Courtesy of Anthony Ha. And is that it for news?
Yeah, I think that's it.
Okay, let's move on to our review. This week, we're talking about Netflix's limited series, Godless, which was produced by Steven Soderbergh and has a lot else going for it, too, including some good actors. And I don't know who did the directing, do you?
So it was this guy, Scott Frank, and he wrote and directed every episode. So I think that even more than Steven Soderbergh, he's
the driving creative force.
Yeah, and I think probably... So Scott Frank, he's written some of Soderbergh's movies, I think, in the past. He wrote Out of Sight. He wrote, I guess that's the big one. Mm. And so he, I assume that probably he just has this relationship with Soderbergh. So Soderbergh, signed on as a producer, but I think it's really his show.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, and it, I mean, so do you want to do, you want to do a spoiler-free and then a spoiler version?
Let's do spoiler-free first.
Okay, so no spoilers. You can listen safely if you haven't seen it. Let's get into the basics and then general impressions.
Right.
So yeah. What's the basic premise here?
So the basic premise is that there's this town, is it called LaBelle? Is that?
Yep.
Yeah. The men there basically all worked in this mine that had this accident, and they were all killed in the accident. So it's basically a town of just women, with a few exceptions, including the sheriff, played by Scoot McNairy. And then this town sort of gets caught in the middle of this conflict between this gangster, played by Jeff Daniels, and sort of his protege, played by this new actor, Jack O'Connell. And then Michelle Dockery, also from Downton Abbey, also has a pretty significant role.
Yeah. 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 It's like, and it's a limited series, which we talked about before. So, and very clear from the show that it's intended to be these seven episodes, and nothing else.
Right.
Now that you've said that it's same writer and director across, that makes total sense. Because to me, it really did feel like almost one continuous 7 hour long movie. Which
yeah.
Sounds bad, but is good for me.
Right. Well, since we're talking about format, I mean, one of the things that I thought was interesting, but I had a little bit of a hard time with was like, was just the fact that the, that essentially, you know, like, and people brought this up a bit with the OA last year, which was another Netflix show, where like the episode lengths just were like all over the place.
Yeah.
And that was true here too, where you just kind of would get an episode and you'd be like, I mean, and on the one hand, you're like, look, this is, you know, narrative art and does not, you know, like, so like it shouldn't have to just be cut to a specific, you know, every episode needs to be 42 minutes long or whatever. And that I think is fine. But especially because I think in this case, where it wasn't just that, you know, the first episode and the last episode were extra long or something, it just, every time I would load up an episode and especially the early episodes were all more than an hour, I just felt like, oh man, oh, it's going to be a long one.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And some of them do feel a bit long, but I think it was, it was the best way to use that though, that I've seen thus far. Like some of the other ones with the Marvel shows too, they vary quite a bit episode to episode.
Right.
But I feel like that's not always necessarily in service of narrative because they have a lot that feels like filler regardless. Whereas yeah. This was like, oh, that's what they needed to do to tell this part of the
right.
story.
So. Right. Yeah. I think the other difference though is yeah, just that I think like a lot of shows when they vary, it's still within this window of let's say 45 to 60 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
And this blows way past that.
Yeah.
Consistently.
Yeah. Is there anyone that's less than an hour? They're all like,
I think a couple of the ones towards the end of the season go under an hour, but like all of the initial, like the first three, or four, all go past an hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, well, like I think like the third episode's like an hour and 17 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So not quite like movie length, but like, you know,
but nearly there. Yeah.
Yeah. Getting there. Like certainly like a short movie from like the 30s or 40s. Yeah.
Yeah. but yeah, I think the format works for this kind of, I think it was like, and I hinted at this before, but I think it was like something I'd like to see more of. Like I thought, oh, this is like this new interesting, and it's not new. Like there have been miniseries before, especially in a lot of like UK and European television. Like that's a very popular way to do this is to do one or two series and have them be seven or eight episodes and that be it.
Yeah.
But I liked it here, and I think that it's a thing that Netflix should kind of lean into and be like, this is the way we make media that's different than anybody else, right? It's like bingeable, but coherent, but like succinct, and doesn't go into, doesn't unnecessarily draw out for the purposes of returning value through syndication, right? Like it doesn't need to go eight seasons with 26 right. episodes per, like they don't need to do that. So why bother trying to emulate that? Whereas this is more what I like. I don't know.
Right. And I mean, in some ways it's also related. It's not quite the same thing, but related to the model of like the anthology shows like, Fargo or True Detective where,
they could do another series, but have it be sort of essentially a totally different.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, you just look at this cast, like Michelle Dockery and Jeff Daniels. I mean, you have to imagine that probably part of what was attractive to them was that they could, you know, work on this project for presumably, but what I assume was, a good amount of time, but that they wouldn't be expected to come back year after year.
Yeah, for sure. That's right. That's the way you get this, like some higher quality of talent or whatever. Some players like, I mean, Daniels especially, right? Like he was very good in this, but he's not the type to like sign on for a show for over and over and over again. But,
right. Although he was in the newsroom.
Yeah, that's right.
But I imagine that you don't, I think getting, you know, maybe one of these stars for a multiple year commitment is maybe doable, but to get this many,
all of
them together, I think, I mean, I don't know, you know, this is just speculative, but my sense is that, that part of what, yeah, is that it's a one-off thing.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, but I, other than that, like, I mean, aside from format, I just thoroughly enjoyed this start to finish, plot-wise, acting-wise, story-wise, everything. I thought it was great. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is, like, for something like this, you, with Westerns, like, I think there's a couple of things that are sort of in the back of my head where, like, one is just like, to what extent is this going to be like a sort of regular Western versus like a more kind of revisionist Western, something like Unforgiven, which is like specifically about sort of upturning, you know, some of the like sort of cliches of Westerns, or is it just more about like telling a straightforward like Western story?
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess specifically like a Western on TV, you just have the shadow of like Deadwood, which had this, you know, just amazing, beautiful, you know, profanity filled language.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that sense, it was sort of not quite as good as I was hoping for, because I thought it was a fairly straightforward Western in a lot of ways. It just had more characters and more plot. And I think it was definitely done with like a 21st century perspective. And there's some interesting things that I think where it sort of expands the format. And then I think it's just like the writing is good, but not great, I would say, in terms of just like the quality of dialogue. So I didn't necessarily like fall in love with it, but I mean, I thought it was good. I mean, and I think particularly like there's a couple of like, yeah, interesting twists on the format, and just all the performances across the board are just really, really great.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no, it doesn't do, I never saw, Deadwood, but
yeah,
it doesn't go out of its way to like transport you to sort of like a different and like contained and cohesive place with its own dialogue and its own feel that's like internal to the show. It feels pretty, yeah, it feels traditional in a lot of ways, like from a Western perspective, but I still thought, I thought it was, the writing was smart and the dialogue was smart. There was very few parts where I felt like it was cringeworthy or anything. There's a couple though, actually, but I don't remember the specific instances, but that would be for spoilers anyway.
One thing I would say is like the way the initial treatment of the Scoot McNairy character's losing his eyesight, I thought was this interesting thing where at first I was just like, oh, and because he says explicitly, oh, I started losing my eyesight when my wife died. And I felt like that felt kind of like cliched and you're just like, come on, there's like gotta be some, you know, I don't know the exact state of technology like in that period, right. But there's But then right at the moment when I was really getting fed up with it, they kind of resolved it in an interesting way.
Yeah. In general, his stuff was, I felt like maybe they had layered too much on to his character. Like any one of the three things that kind of afflicted him with would have been fine on its own, maybe. And they like stockpiled these three, which I won't get into in detail here, but that I kind of was like, okay, I guess so. But it was a weird layering. And because it was like clearly meant that they were tied together in some way, but they never really drew out why these things were tied together or even gave you enough hints, I think, to put them together. I don't know. It was a bit weird. His character and motivation was, but he is terrifically acted. Like he did a great job, but like there are a whole bunch of things about his particular character that I think were problematic, and maybe the most difficult part of the show for me in terms of just kind of like accepting it without question. So I don't know. I'm talking around it because it's the spoilers part.
All right, we'll get to spoilers soon. I'm trying to think. So, I mean, the other person who I think, I mean, I don't have anything against the actor, but there's this character played by Jack O'Connell, Roy Good, who I think in some ways is just sort of the thinnest character because he feels like, you know, he's just sort of like the heroic.
Yeah, I would say he doesn't do anything that character. Surprises me.
Yeah, and there's just not as he feels less interesting and less like when he's on screen. He's not bad, but he's just like I enjoyed his stuff probably the least of all the characters. I think it was just the least compelling and complex.
Yes. Yeah, I think that and a good counterpoint to him was kind of, I mean, he was his counterpoint in the movie, but the Jeff Daniels character was like more interesting, right? Like more complicated. He wasn't, in a lot of ways, he was like a straight up villain, but in other ways, he was not, right? And that was, there was just a couple of, they did enough to make him a bit more complex than that, than being a straight up, like, oh, black hat, white hat, cowboy thing, right?
Right. A lot of that is, about his relationship with Roy Good. I mean, he's definitely like, still kind of fits into this sort of type of this, like, you know, incredibly charismatic villain who can like sort of articulate this really kind of nihilistic worldview with great obviously written speeches and monologues. Yeah. But he's so good at it. And I mean, and it is like really great to see Jeff Daniels in this role, who I think, at least I think of him as a much more sympathetic figure. And so just seeing him, not just as the villain, but as like someone who's capable, like a character who's, you know, downright like, you know, monstrous and scary, I think was really impressive.
Yes. Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. I mean, there was a lot about him that felt like because he does do a lot of monologuing, and that's kind of like a pretty typical Western style thing. Right. But yeah, he really, and I think that's where any of the deficiencies in terms of it being kind of like rote from a Western perspective, a lot of times were made up for by the actors. Like the actors just really seemed to embrace it and like revel in it, and the delivery brought it around. Part of what I liked about it was that it did feel like, to me, like a Western, like a traditional Western that I would have liked watching. But it had enough difference and enough sort of things they did to distinguish it from that tradition that it was good without it being like a reversal.
And I mean, I think a lot of that has to do with the, you know, that basic setup of the town where all the men have died, which is weirdly, I mean, I think initially sort of in the background, because it's really more about just how scary the Jeff Daniels character is, and he's chasing after this other guy. And then slowly you kind of start to understand the backstory of the town. But, you know, thinking, you know, just this creating this context, because I think, you know, we think of Westerns as being such a male-driven genre, such a male, like, you know, a storyline driven by the actions of men. and then women are sort of like the supporting characters. And that's somewhat true here, but then you just have this town that's been running on its own with just women. And then Merritt Wever plays this, the sister of the sheriff, the widow of the mayor. And she definitely, I think, sort of explores some new territory for a Western. And so I think like...
she was the strongest part of that aspect of the storyline, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is still, you know... And I don't think it's entirely unrealistic to say, look, like, yes, we're going to have women who just really, really want men to come back and to, and in some ways to be sort of, you know, closer to kind of, to fall in with like gender norms and stereotypes. But I think that was definitely like one of the more interesting and different aspects of the show was sort of trying to explore, you know, a different, you know, a more of a woman's perspective on the Western.
Yeah, and if anything, I mean, that was maybe the part where I felt like it was a bit disappointing in that they made it a very overt part of the storyline, but I feel like in practice they did a lot that denied that or that like contradicted that in terms of the structure and the who they followed during the plot and how they did that. So it was to me that I was a bit conflicted there. Like I was like, oh, it's good that you're signaling this and that you're saying, you know, that you're making women like very central, powerful characters in this. But then also they spend so much time on the men, and it still is a men led story in terms of the main action of the plot, I think. So
yeah, I think that's true. And then if I were to think about like who the most memorable characters are, like we were saying, I mean, the Merritt Wever character, or yeah, I think it's Merritt.
Yep.
Weaver.
I think it's like, oh yeah, I don't know how you pronounce it, but
you know, I think she was really memorable. I think Michelle Dockery, I think her character is maybe a little bit less memorable, but she's just such a great on-screen presence. But once you get past those two, like the rest of the people really driving the story are all men.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, this was for sure one of the Netflix original shows that I have liked the most, and even because it's sort of a cross between longer form stuff like movies and TV shows, like across all of those things, this was one of my favorites. And I think it was a combination of the acting and the storyline, and also it just feeling like a Western, like the kind of Westerns that I grew up watching as a kid. So, you know, maybe part of it is nostalgia, but I also just felt like it didn't have any clumsy or embarrassing or like amateurish moments in it. That is sort of part of a lot of the Amazon or the Netflix shows for me, like a lot of the Netflix Marvel shows and stuff. They have parts where they just show like, yeah, they just, there's parts where they become absurd or silly or something like that. And this had none of that. So it was just really well executed, I thought, across the board.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that just, it is just really solid and like good looking and like just really, you know, just like it, I think it like sort of scratches that itch of like, if you just want like a Western, like it hits those buttons really well. Like characterization is good. Writing is good. The performances are, you know, good to amazing. I think, you know, that's an interesting point, like where you were talking about like that there's nothing sort of clumsy or ridiculous about it. And I don't think it's entirely a fair comparison, but as you said that, it sort of made me think of a show like The OA, which was also a Netflix original, which I think had plenty of moments that were embarrassing and crazy. But I think also had moments that were just like transcendently great. Yeah. And I would argue that like Godless sort of doesn't have either extreme. It like never has a moment for me that where it really sort of like takes off and is just totally amazing. And it also doesn't have any moments where it's like actively bad. It's just like, you know, kind of just solid, like kind of straight down the middle all the way through.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt like, I mean, just at the end of it, I felt like more satisfied than I've ever felt with any Netflix narrative media. So to me, it reached into the excellent. It was like, this is the best thing I've seen on this service that they created. But yeah.
All right.
Cool. So you want to get into spoilers a bit?
Let's get into spoilers.
Okay. So please turn off your podcast apparatus or skip ahead to the conclusion using the chapter feature if your thing supports that, because we are getting into spoilers about Godless. There. Enough of a disclaimer.
Okay.
Okay, so... Yeah, I think that if I had to... I mean, obviously, I liked it a lot, as you just heard, but what I had the biggest problem with, I guess, was just that... Yeah, the premise on its surface sounds a lot like it is inverting that sort of gender typical thing about Westerns, where this town is entirely women. It's a woman-focused show, but then it's not. It doesn't... Even the poster, right?
Right.
The poster is like women facing down people, which is the culminating moment, but like so much of it is it focuses on Roy, and it focuses on Bill McNew, the
right.
sheriff from the town, and on Frank Griffin. And those are the three. You mentioned Mary Agnes, the Merritt Weaver
right.
character. And she does a standout too, but like those three take up almost all the air in the room
right.
in terms of narrative.
It's
time
their
and attention.
Story.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the people. So the other thing is like the major dramatic action is all caused by, it's caused by men, and then it happens to women. Right. Like
right.
even the reason that, that Jeff Daniels, that Frank Griffin finds Roy in LaBelle and comes to LaBelle with his posse to begin with, which sets up the major like dramatic conclusion of the series, is because of a guy. It's because of that A.T. Greig newsman, like portrayed by Jeremy Bob, right? Like he's the lever for the major action to take place. So, and then the resolution is also guys. Like it's like, you know, they set up and they're defending and they do a great job of it, but ultimately, the turning point is when the men show up, when Roy Good and Bill McNew show up, right?
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think it's, that's why I guess part of what I was saying, like where it's not exactly a revisionist show, it sort of, I think, expands sort of the kinds of topics and characters maybe that you might see in a sort of normal Western, but it isn't as radically different as maybe I would have expected or hoped for. And in a lot of ways, it is much more of a, despite the concept, a much more traditional Western.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that, I mean, and again, it doesn't like necessarily impact my enjoyment of it as a creative work, just because all the other parts were so well done. But like, it's a little bit disappointing because it feels like it was a misleading portrayal of it or positioning of it versus what the
that's interesting, because I feel like I went into it with like almost no idea at all, except just like, oh, you know, Western with you know, from Steven Soderbergh with Jeff Daniels and Michelle Dockery. That's really what I knew going into it.
Yeah, I don't think that they necessarily did a lot to mislead. Like it was like, it's just that all the official taglines I've seen, like a town mysteriously made up of entirely women or whatever. And
right.
on the poster, it's Welcome to No Man's Land with that portrayal again. Like, it seems like they were really playing that up. But again, I don't think anybody involved in the creation of it was necessarily doing that. It was like
right.
the way that they decided to market it. Because in the show, it does, it feels like that is not their emphasis. That's just like a narrative device that they found was interesting and a good way to frame this story, right?
Yeah. And it becomes, I mean, I guess where maybe the other problem is that then it becomes just a way to suggest that this town, that what's dramatically interesting to them about this setup is that it makes the town more vulnerable.
More vulnerable, right.
When you know, Frank Griffin rides into town to you know, to cause havoc, which is maybe not great.
No, but they do invert that a bit, because they like use Greig as the mouthpiece to like express that like overtly.
Yeah.
Even in his article, he's talking about like, you know, he just basically says the town is a mess because of it's only run by women, which is false. But he also, the other part about that is that we have a previous example of what happens when Frank Griffin comes to town. Like, the show opens with that, right? Which is he's killed everyone. He's massacred an entire town
right.
in yeah. a horrific way. and while apparently suffering no casualties himself, like his crew.
Right. That, I mean, the only casualties he suffers are from his earlier encounter with Roy Good. And then Ben, he's real mad because he knows his arm's about to get cut off. So he comes into town and just kills everyone without any cost to himself.
Yeah. And he loses his arm. Yeah. And he, but that's again, Roy Good is the one who did that. Right.
That's what I'm saying.
It's the guy. But so then that's a nice contrast to the actual situation of when they face off in LaBelle. I mean, the other thing being that the other town didn't really know it was coming. But LaBelle puts up a hell of a fight. Like, they basically thin the posse, like Frank's posse, to nothing. And then the guys come in and do cleanup. But it is positioned in the show as though if the guys didn't come up and do cleanup, like, it was going to be over for the ladies of LaBelle, basically. But on the other hand, they fought them basically to a standstill. So at least you got that. I mean, and then if you like the other thing that was like, because it's still portrayed like they are in a victim position because they're all women. Right. Like the other,
right.
Maybe the more troubling part about it is they have the Blackdom town nearby, which is the town made up exclusively of, black military veterans and their families who have decided to like homestead and make farms and stuff now that they're no longer soldiers. And they're used basically as a demonstration of what Frank and his posse are capable of just before they come to LaBelle, right? Like, they're basically set up as pure victims. Which was, I thought, really disappointing. That was maybe the most disappointing part of the show for me. I knew it was coming because once they arrived there, you were like, well, this can only go one way, but it was too bad.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to one of the things we were talking about earlier where it's, I do think that it's great that they've sort of opened up the story to incorporate, you know, not just white guys who tend to dominate Westerns.
And all the rest of their portrayal was good, and I thought, like, felt like it would be accurate for the time, right?
Right,
like,
and it's not that every woman on the show needs to be this completely heroic, powerful character, because, of course, it was a really fucked up time for women. And so I think you got to be honest to that to some degree, but at the same time, it feels like, to an extent, that it's still the white guy's story.
Yeah.
And so that it would have been better if really, regardless of how, you know, heroic or powerful one of these women characters is, that it's as much their story as it is Roy Good's or Frank Griffin's.
Exactly. That would have been more. That they're not just plot devices in the story of the white people, but like, regardless of what happens to them, that they are like a focal point instead of things in service of the larger narrative, right? So, yeah, that's a good way to put it. Especially because, I mean, well, and the parts they were in were great. And it had Eric Harvey from Luke Cage.
I haven't seen Luke Cage, so.
Oh, okay. So he plays Diamondback in Luke Cage, one of the villains. So, and the other main guy is Rob Morgan, who I know I've seen in something. Oh, he's also a Marvel guy. He plays Turk in like all the Marvel shows. You know Turk, the arms dealer?
Oh, huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Also in Mudbound, I just noticed by looking up his IMDb page. But they're good and they do a good job with the role they're given. And I think that through most of the show, it's like, they're interesting, and I like the characterization and how they interact with sort of the other characters. But then, it just felt like a shame that that was the way it went down at the end. And part of that was effective from a narrative perspective because it was like, it is a shame that it went down that way, right? But I'd say that was maybe my biggest problem with it. It was just sort of its use in narrative of some of the things that maybe people were hoping for more from.
This is a much smaller thing, but I will bring it up because it was actually something that I noticed was I think the CG there's there so mostly it's done sort of, you know, on set practically, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
But there are a few moments where they use CGI, and because I don't think the CGI is particularly bad, but because it's just done mostly, practically, like the few moments of CGI are really distracting for me.
Yes.
Like, you're just like, oh yeah, that's a CGI snake.
Oh yeah, like, yeah. I was trying to think of what you're thinking of, but the snake. Yeah,
there's a couple of things where it's just like, I think like some like dust and like, I think maybe a couple, I forget.
They do exactly one, and it must be practical effects because they do the horse when it breaks right. his leg.
Yeah.
That looks really good.
Right. But
I think it is practical effects. So.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, there was just that, mostly just the snake. The snake.
Yeah, they kept that to a minimum. Yeah. And I guess they couldn't have had a real snake in there with the baby,
right.
but you kind of could have. Would have been fine.
Right. Right. You just, or you do what they did in Indiana Jones. They, you know, you put a snake and then there's some sort of like glass between that and the baby
yeah.
and you just erase the glass.
Exactly. Done. That would have been much better. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it wasn't too bad. I think also it was just on my mind because I saw that movie Three Billboards last night, and that also had a very bad CG deer in it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lesson. Don't use bad CG animals in your movies.
Right, right. If someone, somebody's like, hey, like, wouldn't it just be easy if we just put this in with a computer in post-production?
Yeah.
Sometimes the answer is it will be easier, but not as good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do you want to talk about some of the individual performances a bit? I think.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a strength. Like, this had so many actors in it. But so many people did such a good job. Like, I don't think anybody really fell flat. No, everyone did what I think they were intended to do and did it very well. So that was another strength for me. But the standouts, I really liked Scott McNary as Bill McNew, even though I had some troubles with his character. Just the fact that they were like, this is what I was talking about before, where they stacked it. They were like, oh, he lost his wife. Oh, he's losing his vision. Which people interpret as him being a coward. And then he lost his shadow.
Right.
And it was like, okay, why does he need all these things? Like, why not just go with one of those things?
Right. Although losing his shadow, I think, is meant to be a reflection of the first two. Right?
I think so too, but it's like, it's just unnecessary. Like, it just felt like an additional layer that was like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, and it felt, I mean, just like having, like, introducing a character, like, at like a, you know, a Western character talking in his, like, dead wife's grave and stuff, it just felt very kind of, you know, not very imaginative.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think, yeah, part of it is just, like, Scoot McNary is just, I mean, he's definitely, like, a very Scoot McNary-ish character.
Oh, yeah, what, so I said Scott, because sort of, I was like, wait a minute, but it is Scoot McNary, yeah.
Which is, yeah, crazy, right?
And he's very Scoot, yeah.
But he's always, like, you know, the kind of, like, slightly set upon an overwhelmed guy, and that, and but sort of an everyman kind of character, and I think that's kind of true here.
Yeah, yeah. And then Merritt Weaver, too, is also great. Like, her character shines throughout the whole thing. And I was like, I recognize her. And then I looked back at some of her roles and I think it might've been the New Girl one.
Oh, all right.
Where in New Girl, she played like, I feel like one of the main characters. Yeah. It was the one guy's ex, but like, it was meant to be like, oh, back when he was unattractive, this was his girlfriend, which sounds like a shitty role, jeez. But I thought she did a good job. So. In that, and then also in this, I thought she did a terrific job.
Yeah.
You also had Thomas Brody Sangster, who was Whitey.
Yeah, he was probably my favorite character.
Yeah.
At least sort of like the sort of, dark horse stealth fave.
Yeah. Yeah, he was good, despite being seeming like a small role.
Right. Yeah. But I loved, how he was like, this complete like twerp. I mean, and again, like it's another thing where like it starts with the sort of the kind of very traditional introduction where you just see him talking into a mirror and like playing with his guns and you're just like, oh my God, this guy's gonna be, and then like you actually see that he actually can shoot and be sort of heroic.
Yeah.
I thought it was just really enjoyable and well done.
Yeah, I thought so too. And then I also thought his end was very good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the spoiler part of the episode. So
yeah.
Who's killed in the final showdown with Frank's crew fairly unceremoniously and before he gets a chance to have a shot off. And it's just very, it works emotionally the way that they want it to. It was good.
Yeah, I just think, that guy, the actor Thomas Brody Sangster, just has an amazing face too.
Yes, he really does. He really does. It's hard to really narrow down. I'm trying to like pick highlights, but like everybody in this was good. Like Kim Coates as the shitty mercenary guy too. Like just perfect. It was a very Kim Coates role, but you know who I'm talking about?
No, I'm looking at the IMDb page right now.
He's the guy, the black goatee and mustache.
Oh, yeah.
Working for the mining company.
Right. Yeah, he's got a great face.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, he seems like a sleazebag. He was a perfect sleazebag in this series. That worked well. A.T. Grieg, too. Although, I thought it was weird that they gave him the weird, like, leaky eye. Right. Because that's like a classic trope of like, oh, this sleazy character has this physical disability, right? It was like, oh, okay, well, that's kind of shitty of you. But, and Sam Waterston from, what is it, the Law and Order?
Yeah, well, from Law and Order. And then he was also, like Jeff Daniels, he was on The Newsroom.
Yes, yeah. He was good. I almost forgot he was in by the end of the series because he's in the earlier episodes only and then killed by Griffin. But
yeah,
he did a great job. He was like the old-time cowboy, and I think he did it
right.
Well.
Well, and I mean, like, I think the other thing was just because in The Newsroom, he'd played this sort of like kind of past his prime kind of doddering character it frankly made me a little worried about how present Sam Waterston was.
And
I think seeing here, even if he sort of has, not the most, heroic ending, like he's still like, I think is still this really present, like on top of it, heroic kind of, almost paternal character.
Well, he has a part that, like, right before his death, there's a part where he says like, oh, I'm coming for Frank Griffin or whatever, like at the end of the episode where he dies, I think, or at the end of the episode before where he dies. And it was good. It was threatening. Like, you took him seriously. Like,
yeah. And I don't think I'd seen, Waterston do that for a while. So it was good just to see like, oh, like he can still, that he's not quite as frail as his Newsroom character was.
Yeah. Yeah. There's again, lots of highlights. I'm trying to think of, the Jessica Sula, who was Louise Hobbs. She was the daughter of the guys from Blackdom, the one guy from Blackdom.
Okay.
And the white, they're the love interest for Whitey.
Yeah, right.
I thought that was like, that scene was really good. That was touching when they did it might have been the most touching, even more than the actual final culmination, was when she goes and finds Whitey's body. And it's like, the context is like after all of her family has been massacred and she's come here and that's basically all she's got left. And
right.
I just thought, and she doesn't say anything, right? It was just like her face was like,
yeah,
oh,
that's,
God.
Yeah. Pretty bleak.
Yeah. And the leads. Jack O'Connell did a good job. I think you're right in terms of like his character being a bit shallow. But he did, with the role, he was likable. He was somebody you wanted to root for. He came across as genuine in terms of his experience, the life experience and stuff and backstory. Because at first I was a little bit like, how could somebody who is with Frank have come across at all with any kind of good left in him? But they did a good job of making it clear that that was kind of, he was raised that way. And then Frank took advantage of it and tried to kind of skew it to his purposes, but was not fully successful. And like making it clear why that would be the case, right? But also, and Jeff Daniels too, like I was talking about it before, I thought it was great. There was like a couple moments where they just gave him enough to make him more three-dimensional. instead of the cartoon villain. Like he had the, well, either his backstory, right, of like how he got started in that to begin with,
right,
was good. Essentially, well, and all,
even just like the whole scene around it, where he, you know, they like kind of come into the camp, and like, you know, or like, and he's sort of like, obviously the whole thing is menacing, but he's just sort of giving this monologue, and he's like, all right, we're just gonna go sleep over there. Oh, but we are gonna take one of your wives. I'm gonna rape one of your wives.
Yeah.
And just the whole way that plays out is just, yeah.
That like, in the context really of his unsettling origin story. Yeah.
Yeah. And then having that frame the origin story.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing was like that sort of, you know, I thought was a little too on the nose is that at one point, you know, like, you are not like God-fearing men. And he says, there is no God out here. This is right. A godless country. And you're like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, he didn't have to say the actual.
It's the title of the show. Word. I got you.
Yeah. But it was still... Yeah, he did a good job. And that was too, that was like another testament to how good he was, is that he could deliver that line and I wasn't completely thrown out of it, even though it's the name of the show.
Right.
Also, yeah, he had the moment, there was the one brief one where it was a flashback to young Roy Good kind of calming him when he's waking from sleep, like completely unaware of his surroundings and was sort of lost in a flashback moment or whatever and threatening his like crew.
Yeah.
Remember that towards the end of the thing?
Yeah. That was good.
Yeah. That was good. And then I also with his thing with Truckee, with the, like him being the one to like, kind of like, and he turns manipulative, right? Like when he's, explaining to Truckee how he has to shoot his own horse and giving him the gun to do it, like after his horse is injured.
Yeah.
Truckee being kind of the substitute son for Roy Good, right? But I thought that was really strong. And then he turns it, right? He's like, it looks like he's going to go down the same path that he did with Roy. And that was good too. That was a good moment of like, here's how it could have happened. Here's how he still has
right.
enough good in him left to like make this believable that this happened to Roy too.
Or at least, yeah, enough of this sort of like charisma and
yeah.
like honesty.
Yeah, not necessarily true good. Yeah.
I will say one other thing about the show is when I watched the first episode, I was like eating dinner and it like opens with this like shot of like, or very close to the beginning of Jeff Daniels's like, almost severed arm.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, I don't know if I should have eaten. And
yeah, they went very well. It was real.
And then they cut to like Scoot McNairy with like shit smeared all over his eyes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was
yeah.
just like, oh, never mind.
Yeah. I thought it was going to go that way too, but they didn't go that way. It was not overall an extremely gory.
No. Program. It just opens with like, I mean, within the first 15 minutes, there's just two like, fairly gross images.
Yeah.
For different reasons.
Yeah. I think actually time to wrap up. Just unless you had any other major thoughts.
No. No.
I know. I think I monopolized that a bit, but I felt more strongly about it than
yeah, because I was more just like, this is pretty good. I mean, yeah. I think yeah. If this, I don't think it's essential or necessarily the best thing that Netflix has done, but it's quite good.
And I think exactly the opposite, that it is essential and also the best thing that Netflix has done.
Right. So you know, if you feel like one of us is definitely wrong, feel free to tell us so over email or on Apple Podcasts, where you should also subscribe and leave a review.
Yeah, or on Twitter. You can harangue us on Twitter if you want.
Yeah.
But thanks, Anthony. I think we'll be back possibly next week. We're going to be in Europe.
I think we can make something work. Hopefully, maybe a shorter episode or something.
Return to our in-person shenanigans.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, I think, still our least popular episode of all time. So
get ready.
Definitely do that.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Thanks for joining us. And yeah, again, please do review, rate, comment, subscribe, all those things. Helps us a lot. And we'll see you next week.
Yep. Thanks for listening.